I perceive that we concur in thinking that we must go home to be happy, and that our home is not in this world. Here we have nothing to do but our duty, and by it to regulate our business and our pleasures, and travelers through the world, as we all are, may without scruple gratefully enjoy the good roads, pleasant scenes, and agreeable accommodations with which Providence may be pleased to render our journey more cheerful and comfortable. But in search of these, we are not to deviate from the main road, nor, when they occur, should we permit them to detain or retard us. The theory of prudence is sublime, and in many respects simple. The practice is difficult, and it necessarily must be so, or this world would cease to be a state of probation. When John Jay wrote to Lindley Murray in London in 1794, he was expressing a fairly conventional view that life is a test for worthiness in the afterlife. But among those creative thinkers that were the founders of the American Republic, what other views were held about life and death? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What did George Washington think about capital punishment? What did John Adams and Thomas Jefferson have to say about growing old? And why did Ethan Allen believe in reincarnation? And was he the only one? Our guest, once again, is John Kaminsky, director of the Center for the Study of the American Constitution.
Welcome back to University of the Air.
Good to be back.
I would think that the topic of death in this early period in the American Republic would be ever present in people's mind because death was so much more common, death of children, death in childbirth. Can you give us some sense of just the facts about death in this period?
Yes, well, I think you're right. It was much more common, both because people did die at an earlier age for the most part, and I have to qualify that, but also there was a sense of community, a larger sense of community that we've lost in society today. I know when I would see my mother-in-law, and she lived in a small town. She died when she was 90 years old, but whenever she came and saw my wife, she'd always say, "Remember Mrs. Smith? She passed away," or "Mr. Jones." She knew everybody who died. She went to all the funerals. Well, that's the way it was back then, 200 years ago. Today, however, I think it's more a internal family kind of situation. You deal with death more limited outreach. But these people, for instance, Abigail Adams, living in her small town, she, I would say every third letter that she wrote to her husband when he was away mentioned death of one kind or another, whether it was just passing or whether it was intimate, his brother or her mother, and talking about how they died and how it affected other people and how she encouraged people to get over the mourning process. And so there were lots of different kinds of death. I mentioned a little qualifying to begin with. People lived to be very old at this time. We don't really appreciate that. We think people die very young. Well, you get a lot of infant mortality, childbirth, death, and both mothers and babies dying. And then you have in childhood a lot of deaths as well from various kinds of diseases, and both the children and the mothers are dying there. But if you got to be 20 years old, you had a pretty good chance of living to be fairly old in New England. In New England, if you're a man and you're 20 years old, your life expectancy would be 64.
More temperate climate contributing to that, not as many diseases rampant
in the seasons.
Now,
if you were in Virginia, again, the man would live to be about 48 if they were 20 years old. A woman would live to be about 39. So you see, women had shorter lifespans than men at that time. It's sort of reversed nowadays. And that's primarily because of childbirth and child raising. But if we look at some of the more noted founders in this period, you look at a man like Franklin, who's 84 when he dies, John Adams, almost 91 when he dies, Jefferson, 83, James Madison, who wouldn't have given much hope for a long life when he was a young man. He was dying all the time. He lived to be 85 years old. And so once you got over those initial dangers of you got a pretty good chance of living a long life.
What about diseases like smallpox, for example?
Well, there are a number of things that will kill you off. One is war. And so if you were involved in war, and there were four colonial wars before the American Revolution in the 18th century. So this is a problem, both in combat, but more importantly, more deaths in diseases and in suffering after the wounds, not necessarily in the actual battle itself. But then you had also dangerous occupations. Whaling, fishermen, merchantmen, lumberjacks. And this could devastate a community if you have a whaling vessel that goes away. First of all, they're gone for a year or 2 years. That you're, in essence, a spinster, a temporary widow, let's say, when your husband is gone. But if the ship goes down, you've lost a whole generation of men, and you have to start all over again. And so what happens is the women band together in these New England towns for support. You have spinsters. There's not enough men for the women, and also widows. And they do things that they're not supposed to do according to the law that limits what women can do economically and from a judicial point of view.
They become heads of businesses.
That's right. That's right.
Property owners.
There's no alternative for them. They have to take control of the family farm, the family business, and they do. When the husband comes back, things might change, and they'll go back to their old role, not very happy necessarily because they like that responsibility. But then you have, you mentioned, Emily, diseases, and there are diseases that come, and often they are epidemic. There'll be dysentery, smallpox, yellow fever. In Boston in 1754, 6,000 out of 16,000 contracted smallpox. And so when you have inoculation starting, it's a dangerous proposition and it's a difficult series to go through. It takes maybe, depending upon your physician, it could take anywhere from 2 weeks to 6 weeks to be inoculated. And it could be very easy or it can be very hard. And so if you looked at the Adamses, for instance, when John was away, he was inoculated before he got married. But Abigail took their four children to be inoculated. And she and John Quincy Adams, not a problem. Charlie, the youngest boy, did not have it take. So he had to be inoculated a second time. And by inoculation, I mean they cut you on the arm and they put in an infected thread. And the hope is you get a mild case of this smallpox. But the daughter, Nabby, had over 600 pockmarks on her body. She couldn't stand. She couldn't sit. She was in total agony. Can you imagine what Abigail felt by exposing her daughter to that? But the alternative was even worse. And so the epidemics were there, dysentery. When John Adams left for Congress in 1775, dysentery set in Braintree. Every family was affected. Some families were wiped out. John Adams's brother died. Abigail Adams's mother treated Abigail Adams. She had contracted the disease. And Abigail got over it, but her mother died. And she it's a pitiful letter to see her writing to her friends and to her husband, explaining how her mother saved her life, that is Abigail's life,
then but lost her own. Mm.
And so there are a lot of these kinds of diseases that do affect communities all over the country, more so in the South, in New England, and in the middle states, New York and Philadelphia. It's in the summer months, and so people tend to leave those areas. You leave Charleston, South Carolina, in the summer to go to Newport, Rhode Island, where the conditions are favorable. You leave the fever season.
An old European tradition, actually.
Yes.
Very, very much so. And another thing that we don't think about quite so much today as being a hazard to life was fire, especially if you have wooden houses or wooden buildings close together in a city.
Oh, absolutely. Jefferson, in 1820, writes a letter to a Maine representative, U.S. representative, and he talks about the Missouri Compromise and how he hated the Missouri Compromise. And he used a metaphor. He said it's like a fire bell in the night. And you could just see the fear that would instill in these people. I mean, you can't stop these fires once they get started. And you have arsons that are going around, whether they be in the Revolution, British incited, that's there, or what others might, Abigail referred to, vagabonds, and how she was worried that they were setting fires. And she was a little upset that there's so many attempts to limit capital punishment that maybe this is going to encourage more of these arsons to commit their crimes.
Can you say something more about the different opinions toward capital crimes in this time? You know, who was in favor of capital punishment? What did they say about the taking of life?
On the books, there are a lot of capital crimes. And when Jefferson went back from the Second Continental Congress, where he wrote the Declaration of Independence, he joined the legislature and he was the chair of a 5-man committee that recodified Virginia law. And they took about 40 capital crimes and reduced them to 2. And that was murder and treason. These were the only capital punishments that Jefferson wanted. That didn't pass right away. It took a long, long time for a gradual diminution of the number of crimes that would be capital crimes. George Washington, there's something in his psyche that he doesn't like to see people die. And so if you see him during the war, for instance, and he has a mutiny, what he would do is he would try the mutineers. Let's say there's a dozen of them, and they would be found guilty. They would all be given a death sentence, and he would have 2 of them executed, and then he would stop. And it was partly his humanity, partly his need for men that did this, but I think there was a great deal of his humanity there. Now, if you look at someone else like Anthony Wayne, he has a mutiny on his hands, too.
Mad Anthony Wayne,
that's
to
right,
speak.
That's right. He wasn't, maybe he didn't have mad as a adjective just yet, but it's coming, partly because of the scene that I'll talk about. He has a mutiny that occurs, and the mutineers take over. And he has to control them, try to control them so they don't maraud as they go on to Philadelphia. But 5 months later, that was January 1781. Now in May of 1781, he's anticipating another mutiny. And it does occur. 12 men in a squad want a mutiny. He has arranged, Anthony Wayne has arranged for this. And he has a crack squad ready. And he orders these men, you fire on the officers or you fire on the mutineers. And they fire on the mutineers and they kill 6 of them outright. One is lying on the ground, wounded. And Wayne comes up to another one, a young boy, and he's lost his musket, drops it on the ground. He says to him, Wayne says to him, pick up your musket and bayonet that man to death.
Fellow mutineer.
Yes. And the soldier says, no, I can't. He's my friend. So Wayne takes out his pistol and puts it to his head and says, you kill him or I'll kill you. And he killed his friend, bayoneted him to death. And the next day, they hang the surviving mutineers. And the person who tells us the story, who relates the story, says, well, these mutineers didn't want to go south. And he said, we all marched south, mute as fish. And so Wayne knew how he wanted to control people. Washington would never have done that. He would have been much more lenient.
How common were duels as a form of reducing the population at this point? Certainly it was a matter of honor, wasn't it, that if somebody somehow impugned your honor, you were sort of duty-bound to challenge them to a duel?
Yes, and most of the times duels didn't amount to very much. I would say only no more than 10% of the time did you even get to the dueling ground. And then even when you got to the dueling ground, often people didn't shoot or they didn't shoot to kill. And so it's the exception rather than the rule that there is a death involved. But there's a different attitude toward this in the North and in the South. And you can see this, the North, they have laws against dueling. And if you kill somebody in the duel, you are to be indicted for murder and you're to be tried and you're to be executed. And after the execution, your body is to be given to the physicians for dissection purposes and then be buried in a pauper's grave. So this was a incentive here not to be involved in duels here. You're not going to win. Even if you win the duel, you're going to suffer. And so when Aaron Burr mortally wounds
Alexander
Hamilton.
1804.
Yes. He's indicted for murder.
Because that's New Jersey. That's a northern state.
That's right. And he's indicted in New York and in New Jersey both. So he runs away. He's a vice president of the United States when he does this. And he goes down to St. Simon's Island in Georgia. And he is welcomed there as a hero. First of all, he's the vice president of the United States. Second of all, he killed the damnable Alexander Hamilton, who they didn't like in the South. And third, he lived up to the honor of the dueling code. And so he was given all kinds of exotic foods down there, and he was welcomed and stayed there for a while until the indictments were let to die. And he was then welcomed back and took over the role again as vice president. It was a little amusing. There was a little tiny article in the newspaper when Samuel Chase was indicted, impeached. And the little item in the newspaper said, "What an irony. Usually the murderer is brought before the judge. But in this case, the judge is brought before the murderer."
Oh, yes.
as Burr presided over the Senate on the impeachment.
I suppose another place where you see deaths happening in kind of horrific ways would be between slaves and masters, the killing of slaves, although you would have masters wanting to protect their so-called property. But a little later than this time period, you have Douglass writing about slaves being shot and no one getting prosecuted for murder.
And you have slaves killing masters.
Oh, absolutely. It's a two-way street here. Obviously, it's not an even two-way street, that the masters have all the advantages on their side, and there are terrible, horrendous cases of masters treating their slaves very cruelly and arbitrarily, even though there are laws that protect slaves, that you cannot arbitrarily kill a slave, but it obviously happened. But the fear that the master always had is, what are those slaves doing to us? How much ground of glass is being put into our food? And so there's always that danger of a slave uprising, which might be large in scope, or it could be very subtle, and it could be very personal and individual. And so that's always a danger that's there hanging over their heads. And so during the darkest periods of the American Revolution, you have some enlightened folks like John Lawrence from South Carolina, the son of Henry Lawrence, the president of Congress, who advocates a black brigade. Several black brigades to fight. We need them. But there was just too much fear to arm blacks with weapons and then to have them engaged in combat. This was just too dangerous. And it was also dangerous to leave your plantations and you have slaves there and your family undefended. So it was a very scary situation for these people. And they could never get over that throughout the entire period of slavery, that you have this fear of slave mutinies, uprisings, whatever. But also the runaways were treated very, very badly by their masters often.
How common was suicide in Revolutionary-era America?
We don't have too much about this, but Jefferson does write about it. He thinks this is a good idea, that once you have exhausted pretty much everything and you're in pain, there's no reason to prolong the death. And so he advocates that there be assisted suicide. And there are certain plants that have been discovered that they do the job, and they do the job in a fairly humane way. He talks about how Frenchmen carry this herb around with them during the French Revolution, so that if they're going to be sentenced to die in the guillotine, they wouldn't want to go through that, so they could just take this. And it's a peaceful sort of death.
But wouldn't they worry about the sort of religious taboos against it, or, you know?
Well, some might, yes. Certainly a Christian point of view. But Jefferson was not a Christian. And so Diaz would think that there's nothing wrong with this, even when you have the sense of the hereafter, that this was an understandable thing, that the Creator didn't really want you to suffer. And so this was an avenue for you to take. He was very cautious about this, didn't want this to be taken out of the hands of the physicians. So the physicians should be involved in counseling people. So it shouldn't be widespread, but in certain cases, this was the right thing. Most of the time at this time, the older people are revered, and the idea of suicide for them is not very prevalent. But there is a fear that people have, men like Jefferson, you see this all the time. What they fear is senility and dependence on others. And so these are things that they would like to avoid in their old age. And Jefferson does refer to a number of people that have, he calls them, they become grasshoppers or they become a cabbage.
Yes, right.
These are two metaphors that he uses. That, so we would say a vegetative state. He uses cabbage as that. And I've heard people sort of make fun of that. You know, it sort of is funny at first when you see the word cabbage. But this was not a funny thing for Jefferson. It was a very, very serious thing.
We'll look at the community support system to death and dying in the American Revolutionary era when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
So short-sighted and so little away can we look into futurity that we ought patiently to submit to the dispensation of heaven.
That was Abigail Adams to John Adams, writing from Braintree, July 16, 1777. This is George Washington to Brian Fairfax from Valley Forge, March 1, 1778. The determinations of Providence are always wise, often inscrutable, and though its decrees appear to bear hard upon us at times, is nevertheless meant for gracious purposes. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, John Kaminsky, who's filling us in about attitudes toward death and dying in Revolutionary-era America. And you mentioned already, John, that there was a greater sense of community around death at this time, late 18th century. But part of that would be, of course, because you didn't have a lot of choice. It's not as if you could farm out a terminally ill person to a hospital. You had to have that person at somebody's home. And that went well into even the early 20th century for many places.
That's right. And in fact, there's not a great deal of religiousness involved in this either. For the most part, it's a secular thing, dying. And when people die, when they're dying, they're in a dying state, you have people come in and watch over them to make sure their needs are met, or if they do die, then the people will come and service them. They wash them and they'll dress them. There's a certain attire that you wear for your funeral. Your casket has been prepared and you will be buried very quickly. And you might pass by a church, and the later you go in the period, the more likely you will stop in a church. In the 17th century and the early 18th century, you had funeral sermons, but they were never given during the funeral. They were always given on a Sunday after the funeral had taken place.
Oh, as part of a regular Sunday service. That's
right. And very seldom did they talk about the departed person. That is something the sort of the eulogy gets started more in the Revolutionary period, much later, 125 years after the settlement of America. And this all happens very quickly. It gets you in the ground. There's no refrigeration. There's no embalming to speak of. That was tried for a very short period of time and then fell into disuse.
For 100 years or close to.
That's right. And so what happens is you get, for instance, the tremendous funeral of John Hancock. He's not part of it. He's already been buried because of necessity, but there's a certain process that has to take place, and the preparation of the body and the preparation of the events, and the more time you have to prepare, the better it is. And so you have also the giving of gifts. And so this is a phenomenon that has sort of run its course by about 1790, because it's so expensive. They give gloves. Gloves are the main gift that's given out.
To the family of the departed? Or
No, the family actually gives it out to guests.
Oh.
And so in some of the bigger funerals, sort of like state funerals.
Lots
and
of gloves.
One, there was 4,000 pairs of gloves given out. And there are other things like rings and scarves that are given out by the family to the point where there are laws passed that prohibit this because 20, 30, 40% of the estate is being squandered on this. There was one minister in New England that when he was getting older decided he wanted to sell his gloves. He had 3,000 pairs of gloves that he had obtained. And the gloves go in different quality so that the more aristocratic people and their minister would get a higher quality pair of gloves than person down the street might get. When John Jay died in 1829, he puts it in his will. There will be no mourning gloves and no mourning rings or scarves, but there will be $200 given to one person, the most worthy orphan or widow in the town. They have to decide that one person will get $200 as opposed to these mourning gifts that are given. There's also an expense of attire. What do you wear? And again, there's an American approach to this. There was a European approach, and the European approach can be fairly costly, especially for the upper class. You have to wear a certain outfit, and for men and women, both. And it's seasonal, just like a tuxedo would be seasonal. And Abigail refers to poor Mr. Jefferson. They're anticipating the death of a royal member of the royal family, and they want him to die beyond the season so they don't have to have two seasonal mourning clothes here. That would be expensive. But in America, it comes down to a ribbon that's worn or crepe that's worn on your left arm, usually for somewhat of prominence. It'd be a month that you wear this. Women might have a bonnet, or they might have some ribbon that would be dressing up their white dress that they would wear. And so this would be the kind of thing that you would wear to a funeral. Sometimes it might be as a sash, like a military sash, but that was much more reasonable than
all these gloves.
Well, what about support to the family? Let's say it's a family that's lost a child or someone who's lost his wife. What kind of gathering of support would there be?
There are a number of things. First of all, let's say the family integrity is still there. And so let's say it's a child that dies. And there'd be a lot of sympathy that's there. You do have the funeral. Then you'd have a dinner afterwards. And there'd be a lot of consolation. And you would keep this up over a period of time. And you would counsel somebody that they should get over this. That, yes, Jesus has taught us in the story of Lazarus that we should mourn, we should grieve. There's nothing wrong with this. Jesus cried at the tomb of Lazarus, but then he raised him up. And this was a story that Jesus gave us so that he was saying it's all right to cry, it's all right to mourn. But then you've got to get over this. To have a right relationship with God, you cannot keep this up. Now, it's a lot easier said than done. And so when Abigail Adams, when her daughter dies, she has a very, very tough time getting over the death of her daughter, who's about 45 years old and has a family. So it's a double whammy here for her. For a child to die is something that is so usual that they accept this. And I don't want to say that this is painless, but this is acceptable to them. This is sort of the way of life.
In fact, they would sometimes even defer the naming of a child till fairly late in life, wouldn't they? Because
yes.
Otherwise you were losing something even more.
Yes, that's right. But when a child dies who is himself or herself a parent, that is, you're depriving another series of children of their parents, that is a very painful thing. And once they have become an adult and you have an adult relationship with them, that is a very painful process for a mother or father to see their adult child die. So that's probably the more difficult process to have to go through. But there is this bereavement period that's there, and there is a consolation. Later on, I think we'll read a couple letters of condolences, and you can see the kinds of things that they're talking about here. Now, other things happen, too. If you don't have a viable family that's left, then orphan children will be taken in by other family members or by friends. And this is true even if one of the parents survives. So when Nathaniel Greene dies, one of Washington's great generals, he dies in 1786. His widow survives, and she has two sons. Well, Washington writes and says, I will take the boys in, and I will raise them. I will give them an education, because he was so indebted to Nathaniel Greene. So there's that kind of thing. When Charles Adams, Abigail and John's son dies, they take in a daughter from that, and they help raise her. When Washington's stepson dies, he has four children. The Washingtons take in two, a boy and a girl, and the other parents, grandparents of the children, take in two, along with their daughter. And so Washington has these two stepchildren that he raises, and then the two grand-stepchildren that he raises in his family. When Lafayette is in danger in France, that is when the French radicals turn against him, and he has to run away, and he's captured eventually by the Germans and the Austrians and put in prison. He sends his son, he only has one son, appropriately named George Washington Lafayette, to George Washington, for Washington to tend for him. And Washington is a very touchy diplomatic situation because we're involved here with Washington as president, and he wants to keep America out of war with France and England. And so can he accept George Washington Lafayette in the presidential mansion? Yes, he does. And then he takes him back home with him to Mount Vernon. So there is this kind of support also. And often you'll find young men on the rise are not living with their parents. They're living with their uncles or other people that have taken them in. So there's that kind of support. And I did mention also this support community in New England. Elaine Crane has written a wonderful book looking at four New England seaports and how these women have bonded together to support each other.
Now, how did primogeniture play into things when someone died? Was there not some legal revision, at least in some former colonies, that would do away with that?
Oh, absolutely. Primogeniture and entail are part of the English common law system, that if you die intestate, if you don't have a will, all of the property goes to the eldest son, and nobody gets anything other than that, except for the widow. The widow gets a dowager. With the dowager, usually is one-third. And the widow usually can stay in the house, the family house, for a certain period of time, but eventually has to leave the house unless the heir allows for the widow to stay there. But one of the things that is accomplished almost immediately in Virginia is the elimination of primogeniture and entail. It is thought to be preserving an aristocratic system. It is not Republican. And so you see a lot of the state laws for primogeniture and entail falling away with independence.
What about the cemeteries and the tombstones and graveyard practices? Anything unique about Revolutionary America?
Well, yes. Things have changed a great deal. The cemeteries in the 17th century and early 18th century are pretty well kept. But the tombstones are very bland if there are tombstones, and often they're made out of wood. They're not, and they're just the birth-death dates of the person. No ornamentation at all. This would be thoroughly forbidden by Puritans. But that process sort of gets left behind, and the tombstones become more ornate.
The angels start to come out.
Absolutely. The cherubs and the flowers and that type of thing. And the whole attitude toward death changes, and you see that it's a sense of rebirth, and you have the fire and brimstone and hell and damnation is what you can expect in the 17th century. But in the mid-18th century, after the Great Awakening, you have a sense of the metaphor that's often used is the butterfly coming out of the cocoon. And that's what death is, the cocoon, where the caterpillar goes into the cocoon. But then there's this rebirth that's there, and it's a beautiful rebirth. And so there is this sense that this is a wonderful thing, not to be dreaded at all, and maybe not to be hoped for necessarily. I've always wondered about that, and why Christians are so afraid
not
of that.
Not to rush things.
Jefferson says that, he's not afraid of it, but he doesn't hope to bring it on too quickly.
I remember being in one of the cemeteries in Boston where the tombstones were in nice, neat rows, and somewhere along the line, the information was provided that actually that the rows were created much, much after the fact so that they could mow the lawn more easily.
Yes. Well, that's what I was going to say, too, that although you get the elaborate tombstones, you don't get the care of the cemetery. It sort of is left on its own, and it's not well kept from the point of the grass and flowers, etc. It's not manicured very well. But what you do have, another thing you do have, particularly in the cities, mainly in New York City and Philadelphia, is you have grave robbing taking place. And this is partly because you get medical schools that are being established. You're having lectures, public lectures on anatomy, and the physicians need bodies. And not too many people are willing to give their bodies for scientific purposes. So you have, as part of death sentences, that your body will go to the dissection. I mentioned that for duels, but
right.
It's for other capital punishments too. But then there's in Philadelphia, it was estimated they needed about 300 bodies a year. And so what they do is they first go after the pauper graves, particularly the Negro cemetery. And they go after – because there wouldn't be a hue and cry among the white community if they're exhuming black bodies. But then it goes into the white cemeteries as well. And you have in New York City in April 1788 what's called the doctor's riots. That is, you have medical students who are doing dissections of cadavers, and they're having fun and games with this. And they're dangling body parts out of windows and saying to little boys, "This is your mother's arm I have here."
Goodness.
How gruesome. Yes. And so what happened was they revolted and they were going to execute these medical students. Eventually, the authorities had to put them in jail for their own safety. And even then, they were ready to storm the jails. Governor George Clinton had to call out the militia. And the militia was called out, and a small number of them, and they eventually fired on the mob. And the mob was throwing brickbat and other things, clubs, at these. And so they got George Clinton got injured. Von Steuben got injured. John Jay got injured, hit with a brick in the head, trying to restore order. This is a time when they're debating the Constitution, and the Frenchman, there, Victor Dupont, says, "What a wonderful thing to see anti-Federalists and Federalists come together to restore government here from this mob."
But what a bizarre situation. That has to be one of the weirder conflicts in American history.
Yes, yes.
We'll look at some more thoughts about death and the afterlife when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. I am certainly very near the end of my life. I am far from trifling with the idea of death, which is a great and solemn event. But I contemplate it without terror or dismay, out transit, out finit. Either it is a transformation, or it is the end. If finit, which I cannot believe and do not believe, there is then an end of all, but I shall never know it, and why should I dread it, which I do not. If transit, I shall ever be under the same constitution and administration of government in the universe, and I am not afraid to trust and confide in it. That's John Adams to Thomas Jefferson, January 14th, 1826. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is John Kaminsky, and we're talking about concepts of death in revolutionary America. Let's just take the different founding fathers and sort of the central figures that we have of this period. And can you just give us a sense of what their beliefs were, what they thought would happen to them when they died?
Yes. Well, if we look at Thomas Paine, Teddy Roosevelt once described Thomas Paine in a biography of Gouverneur Morris. He described Paine saying he's a filthy little atheist. Well, he wasn't little. He was about 5'10", and he wasn't an atheist. He did believe in God. He was filthy. He was dissolute, to be sure. But Paine believed in God, and he says this point blank, "I believe in one God, one creator. It's not the Christian God by any means. And he says, I believe that there's a hereafter. And he says, it's not for me to say what the hereafter is going to be, but I certainly hope we don't have these decrepit old bodies. And he talks about the soul and what is the soul. If you cut off both arms and both legs of a man, he still has a soul, a sense of being. And he has this wonderful statement that says even 20 years ago, the body that we have right now didn't exist. That is, the cells that we have weren't there. These are new things. And yet we still have an appreciation of who we were 20 years ago or 40 years ago. So there is that soul that's there. And he says that's what's going to be saved in the hereafter. He says, I don't know what God is going to do, what the Creator will do. There's certainly enough space if we look at the universe. In fact, some people talked about a physical reincarnation. This was not pain at all. But they thought that all we needed was the size of England. We could fit everybody in who had ever lived could fit in England. But Paine said, if I were God, this is what I would do. All those people who had done well in life, who were good, they would be saved and they would go to a nice place, a heaven. All those people who were wicked and evil, they would be punished. Everybody else, he said, I don't really care. It doesn't make any difference. And so he was willing to, in essence, I'll use a very loaded word here, he was willing to abort them in eternal life, that it wasn't important for them, that we can get rid of them. The fact that God allowed a man and woman to have a child didn't put any encumbrance upon God that child survived in the hereafter. So that was Thomas Paine. And so he wanted to live a good life. Jefferson pretty much was in agreement with that. His daughter asked, how do I prepare for death? And how do I prepare for the end of the world? And Jefferson said, no, you can't do that. The Creator didn't tell us how the world was created and hasn't yet told us how it's going to end. But one thing we do know is that we're all going to die. And so we must prepare for death. And that is, listen to your conscience, the internal monitor, he says. That's what God has given us. And that will get us into heaven, whatever that might well be, and we'll be brought back together again. Now, Abigail Adams, she believed that it was very important to do good works. She comes from the Congregational family. Her father was a Congregational minister, but had long since abandoned predestination. And so she believes good works are very important and will help get you to heaven. And she writes this wonderful letter to her son, John Quincy Adams, when he is going overseas when he's 11 years old. And this is during the war, the revolution. And when she realizes he's made it there, she says to him, follow the advice of your father, follow the precepts in religion that we have taught you in your young age, younger years. Well, he's only 11 years old. And if you don't, she says, I would have wished that the ocean you crossed over would have swallowed you up and killed you, or you would have died in some other way before you grow up to be a graceless child.
Wow.
Talk about tough love here.
Yeah, pretty stern.
Yes. But the reason is she had a reason for this, both a temporal and a spiritual reason. The temple reason is she believes that the Creator, God, has given us all different talents, and it's important for us to improve our talents. She says to her husband, we have four geese. One of them is a swan. That was John Quincy Adams. Mm-hmm. So he had to develop his talents. His country needed that. And so that was his responsibility. But also she felt from a spiritual point of view that heaven was going to be a stratified society and that those who were the most meritorious and the most knowledgeable would be given preferential treatment. And so not only would you get a bigger mansion, let's say, and all the accoutrements, but we weren't going to be just sitting in heaven adoring God as many people would have it back at that time. But no, there was a advancement there. And if you started out with better accoutrements, you had a better chance of advancing in heaven. And so that's what she saw as the potential in the hereafter.
But you mentioned that she had a terrible time with the death of her daughter. What would she have thought would happen to her daughter after death then? Was she worried? Was it just the grieving process, or did she then, because her daughter didn't have the same special talent as John Quincy, did she worry about her fate in the afterlife?
She was. I don't think she worried at all about Nabby going to heaven. She was confident about that. What she was grieving about was her own personal loss of her daughter and her grandchildren's, mm-hmm. both the grandson and granddaughter's, loss of their mother. That was what she was grieving about in particular, to lose, as she's getting older, and she's being more and more dependent upon others, Abigail is. She really loses a tremendous amount when her daughter dies. And this is she dies of breast cancer. So it's a sort of a long process, a two-year process of Nabby dying that was difficult for her. And to see her going through pain, to not see her doing this because she was at quite a distance away, but Nabby wanted to come and die in her family's home. And so she did travel 500 miles with her son and her daughter to die at home and be buried in the cemetery. And so Abigail saw that, and that was very painful for her. But it was not the hereafter that really bothered her. Jefferson, he responds to Isaac Story, who was a Princetonian graduate and a minister in Marblehead, the largest church in New England, 3,000 souls, he says. And he sent Jefferson a pamphlet, a manuscript essay on reincarnation, that souls will be taken from those who die prematurely and placed in another body. For them to develop.
Oh, just prematurely, though.
That is the sense that's the case, that they haven't obtained what might be called karma or enough grace to get into heaven. They haven't fulfilled the probationary period,
uh-huh.
didn't give them the opportunity to do so. So not to be condemned, but this is sort of a second purgatory maybe here on earth. And that's what they often picture this as, is a probationary period here on earth. And so Jefferson said, I'm not one to comment on this. I can't say. But he says, when I was very young, I studied this, the hereafter. And I came to the conclusion that I will never be able to determine what the hereafter will be. And he says, I thank my Creator for giving me such a pillow of ignorance that I use over and over again in different areas. I don't have to know everything. He wanted to know everything, but he felt comfortable in certain areas that these are things that we as human beings are never really going to be sure of.
That's a great phrase, pillow of ignorance, sort of the ignorance is bliss, that you can just rest on your ignorance.
That's right. That's right.
And not have to trouble yourself with an answer
or
reaching
true.
For an answer. Reincarnation, though, was that something that was at all prevalent among the founders of the Republic?
I don't think so. There's Ethan Allen was thought to be a believer in reincarnation, and he wanted to come back as a white stallion. Horse was his favorite animal, and white was his favorite color, so that's what he wanted. But I mentioned Isaac Story believing this. He wrote this in 1801. In 1802, his congregation wanted him to resign. So I don't know if that was a connection there between the two. But John Jay believed that there was a third dimension. That is, there was obviously a physical dimension that we were living in, but there was also, just as obvious to him, a spiritual side. But he thought there was a third dimension also that was hard for him to explain what it was. But he was pretty confident that there was this other area. One of the things that the hope would be, we would be reunited with loved ones in the afterlife. I'm never quite sure about how that would be. If you had a child that died, would that child still be a child?
Common question.
Or would they be sort of on the same plane? Because we're talking about souls here,
right.
And spirituality. Adam says to Jefferson in a letter, when we get there, we'll look back and laugh at our botherations, the problems that we have in the world right now, the physical problems that they both were going through.
They're all such amazing letter writers and so eloquent. What kinds of comments stand out for you in terms of the way they would express condolences to each other?
Well, I think one of the most touching of these is John Jay, when he is informed by his son-in-law that his grandson has died. This is his only grandson, his daughter's only son. And he writes a letter of condolences to his daughter. And he says, yes, we're very sad personally that this has happened, that we are being deprived of his company and the joy of having him around. But what do we want for him? What have we always wanted for him? We always wanted him to go to heaven. That's the ultimate goal, and that's where he is. He's just gotten there a bit earlier than we had anticipated, so we should be happy in that regard. But we do have to suffer the lack of his presence here.
Were there some notable deaths among the founding fathers? I remember George Washington being quoted on his deathbed as saying something like, I go with difficulty, but I'm not afraid to die.
That's right. He took it very, very stoically, very bravely. He had a hard time breathing. And that's eventually what killed him, the contraction of his breathing tube, the esophagus. But obviously one of the most symbolic of the deaths in this whole generation is when Jefferson and Adams die on the 4th of July, 1826, the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. And Jefferson had been on his deathbed for several days, and he would awaken and ask, is it the 4th of July? And they would say no. He'd go to sleep again, and he'd wake up, is it the 4th? No, it's not. He'd go to sleep again and wake up, is it the 4th? Yes, it is. Closed his eyes and he died. He was happy. He willed himself to be alive until the 4th of July, knowing how important that symbolism would be. And John Adams, almost 91, as I mentioned before, not in bad physical shape, blind, and an old man, but not on death's door, had a stroke. And later in the afternoon, on his deathbed, he said, Jefferson still lives, not knowing that Jefferson had died. Well, they made a great deal of these two men dying. First of all, they didn't know. In each region, they thought Jefferson has died. And then they thought in New England, Adams has died. But when the word came out that both of them had died on that day, it was God-given. It was meant to be. But perhaps one of the saddest of the deaths, at least for me, is I look at Jefferson writing a letter of condolences to John Adams on the death of Abigail Adams. Jefferson loved Abigail Adams and was very sad to see her die. They had been married for over 45 years, it was, and in 1818, Abigail died, and Jefferson wrote a letter of condolences to his old friend, John Adams.
Jefferson writes from Monticello, November 13th, 1818. Tried myself in the school of affliction by the loss of every form of connection which can rive the human heart, I know well and feel what you have lost, what you have suffered, are suffering, and have yet to endure. The same trials have taught me that for ills so immeasurable, time and silence are the only medicines. I will not, therefore, by useless condolences open afresh the sluices of your grief, nor, although mingling sincerely my tears with yours, will I say a word more where words are vain, but that it is of some comfort to us both that the term is not very distant at which we are to deposit in the same cerement our sorrows and suffering bodies, and to ascend in essence to an ecstatic meeting with the friends we have loved and lost, and whom we shall still love and never lose again. God bless you and support you under your heavy affliction.
That's Thomas Jefferson writing to John Adams on the death of Abigail Adams, not knowing at that point that both Thomas Jefferson and John Adams would die on the 4th of July. John Kaminsky has been our guest on this journey through death in revolutionary America. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.